Welcome to Power Play. On a day when the blueprint for marijuana legalization was released, which could end 93 years of prohibition in Canada when its mere possession gave you a criminal record for life. We'll have the chair of the task force charged with guiding the government on selling legal cannabis and the Liberal MP supervising legalization's implementation. And we will go to Washington to analyze today's key developments by the president-elect, including the Russian sympathizer who will be Donald Trump's diplomatic face to the world. And our year-end regional checkup goes to a suddenly happy pipeline province to find out if Alberta's distressed economy is coming back in 2017. But first, the government struck a 9-member task force last summer to plot the way forward on legalizing cannabis. The final report was released earlier today. Chair Anne McLellan, a former deputy prime minister, joins us to discuss the way forward. Welcome to the program, Anne. Nice to have you with us.
It is my pleasure, Don.
Tell me, try to explain to me what legalized marijuana is going to look like as it rolls out into the real world.
Okay, let me start with production, the producers. Federally regulated, in part for quality control, safety, and so on. So production manufacturing is going to be regulated by the Government of Canada, just as the Government of Canada presently regulates producers of medicinal cannabis. Provinces and territories have the jurisdiction over wholesale and retail. And some of your listeners will have heard that provinces are interested in using some part of their alcohol control infrastructure to distribute and potentially retail cannabis. So in some provinces, I'm speculating, probably in most, you will have some involvement of the alcohol control authority, maybe the back office only. We and then the province flowing down from there gets to determine, it's their constitutional jurisdiction, what retail is going to look like on our streets out there.
You say not with liquor stores, that's your, not your
no,
preferred route.
We actually make a strong recommendation that there not be co-location with existing liquor stores. Mm-hmm. But the provinces have the jurisdiction over what that retail is going to look like at street level. And then the municipalities play an important role here too, Dawn, because the municipalities may very well get to determine permit, well, do have jurisdiction over permitting, mm-hmm. licensing, setbacks from schools, from faith-based organizations, from public parks, those kinds of public spaces where you in particular find young people. So all three levels of government will have a role, but in terms of what the door looks like that you would walk through to buy a cannabis product, that actually is not within the jurisdiction of the Government of Canada. That is within the jurisdiction of the provinces and municipalities.
All right, so you're saying 18 is a minimum or whatever the legal drinking age is, I guess.
We recommend 18, but knowing that most actually provinces have the age of 19 for legal consumption of alcohol, we in the report reference the fact that we presume those provinces that have 19 as the legal age for alcohol will want cannabis sales to be the same age.
Okay, seems to me the marketing, you're drawing a lot of parallels with tobacco in terms of, you know, branding and packaging and advertising.
Against those, in terms of promotion, sponsorship, advertising, yes, and we heard that over and over again from so many people, concerned Canadians, public health experts, and so on, that they wanted to ensure that packaging was not such that, for example, it was attractive to children. Right? So our recommendation around the fact that people are not going to be able to package a product and make it look like a popular chocolate bar, for example, right?
Mm-hmm. Those, no or an edible brownie.
Yeah, no lollipops. none of those kinds of things. But in terms of the packages themselves, yes, very much like tobacco in terms of plain packaging.
See, I have a long memory, so I know you used to be Justice Minister
yes.
here. what prevented you from saying we should go get into this report and talk about blood alcohol or drug testing to find some way to make sure drivers under the influence aren't going around completely stoned out of their minds except for going 30 kilometers an hour under the speed limit. But
well, in fact, we do talk about that in quite some detail in the report. In fact, chapter 4 of our report, if people want to read the report over the holidays. In fact, THC metabolizes differently in the body than alcohol in relation to blood. And we've also had a long experience with alcohol, and we have effective roadside testing, and we know there's we have what you call a per se limit for alcohol.
Right.
The science is not quite there yet in terms of how THC metabolizes in the body, and therefore, without that knowledge, it's hard, right now it's not possible to say that at 0.5, for example, nanograms per milliliter of blood, that should be a per se rule at that point, that the person is impaired. Because what you're focused on here is impairment.
Right.
Is the driver impaired? At what level can we say the THC in the body leads to impairment? And we're not quite there yet, but science is moving really quickly. But that, Dawn, I have got to underscore for your viewers that drug-impaired driving is happening now. It is a law enforcement challenge now. That people are being prosecuted and convicted for drug-impaired driving now.
Mm-hmm.
I think that with legalization and regulation, you're going to see the science driven more quickly, and there is an awful lot of good work being done that hopefully will lead us both to an effective, efficient roadside test as soon as possible, but also move us in the direction of a per se limit, very much like we have in alcohol.
Okay. What I meant is, you didn't have a firm recommendation in the report, but it's still coming. All right.
Okay.
Last question I want to get quickly on this, because it was raised in the House of Commons today. Why didn't you at least advocate, say, look, this legalization's coming, let's decriminalize immediately? Otherwise, all these kids are going to get criminal records over the next year until this rolls out.
That is a decision, obviously not for the task force. That was not within our mandate.
No.
We were focused on legalization and a new regulatory regime going forward, right? And that's our recommendations are exclusively focused on that. But I think in all honesty, it has been very clear that the government has said we're not doing a half measure, which is what it is with decriminalization. And what we're going to do is take the time and get this as right as possible out of the box, and take the time working with the provinces, the territories, other stakeholders to make sure that we have as smooth and as effective beginning for this new regime.
Okay. Anne McClellan, always a pleasure having you on.
It's great
Come
to
back
be
anytime.
Here. I'd love to, Dawn. Thank
right.
you.
Thanks for coming on. All right, let's get the view from the Hill as Canada goes to pot without criminal consequences. Liberal MP Bill Blair is the government's point man on the file. Colin Carey is the Conservative health critic representing Oshawa. And Nikki Ashton, NDP MP from Northern Manitoba, welcome to you all. Bill, I'd just like to get your thoughts quickly. What was your reaction to this report, and I presume the government's as well?
Actually, our government was very clear that we want to reduce and restrict the access that children have to marijuana and to take the profits away from organized crime and to take the steps necessary to protect the health of Canadians. Mm-hmm. To that end, we asked a task force led by Anne McClellan, but we had 9 eminently qualified Canadians who did an enormous amount of work for us. I'm really pleased with the work and the very comprehensive way in which they approached a very complex and challenging subject. And I think the recommendations will be very, very helpful to this government as we go forward.
Can you see that being the actual blueprint as this rolls out?
Again, let's be really clear. These are recommendations. Mm-hmm. And I think the task force approached the job that we gave them in a very responsible way, in a very broad examination of the challenges. They took an approach of, I think, a very cautious approach, mm-hmm. quite appropriately, in how to reduce the social and health harms related to cannabis use. And they've provided us with that evidence and with their recommendations, which I think they'll be very, very helpful. They are recommendations, but it is a very comprehensive review of a very complicated and challenging subject.
Sure is. Colin, Conservatives as happy with this report as the Liberals are?
No, you probably guessed it,
Dawn. Right.
Like, when our approach, we're looking at basically, we have to be very cognizant of the health and safety of Canadians, especially our youth. And to have the recommended age of 18, I think, is very concerning, considering most of the science and the evidence clearly states that up to the age 25, the developing brain, there could be actually permanent and serious psychological consequences of marijuana use. So that's one concern.
And the Kansas City Medical Association, I believe, agreed with you on that, right?
They did, yeah. And then the if you look at the issue of driving and operating motor vehicles mm-hmm. while impaired, really there's no really good test for it. So I've talked to union leaders around the country, and it's like, what about even people at work driving forklifts, things along these lines? What about school buses, things along those lines? So there's some serious things, I think, that this task force didn't really kind of bring forward, and maybe they compromised a little bit, mm-hmm. and that's unfortunate, because when you're dealing with the health and safety of Canadians, particularly our youth, we shouldn't be compromising.
I assume they're doing this now. The marijuana consumption in this country, I'm not sure it's going to increase dramatically under legalization, will it? It's just getting it away from the criminal element. And
you know what, though? And realistically, when the Prime Minister came forward, he said, Don, the purpose of this promise was to take the profits out of organized crime mm-hmm. and taking it out of the hands of kids. But mm-hmm. That's what he said a year ago. You flash forward a year today, you know as well as I do, in your community as well as mine, we have these illegal dispensaries popping up. Their number one sales item apparently is kid-friendly things like gummy bears, things along those mm. lines. The marijuana can be laced with pesticides. There's a mixed message out there, because on one hand, the government says, by the spring, this is going to be legal, but, oh, you should be enforcing it on these people because it's still illegal. So, you know, we've got it, the profits in organized crime and the kid-friendly stuff out there. So I think there's a lot of mixed messages here that we have to take a look at.
Let me just quickly get Nikki. I want to come back to you, though, because sure. former police chief that you are, I'm sure you got some thoughts on that. Yeah. Nikki, NDP reaction? Is this the way to go?
Yeah, well, I mean, the recommendations coming out of this report certainly don't live up to the commitment that Justin Trudeau made in the last election. He had a very clear commitment to legalization. Many people in my generation, many young Canadians, voted Liberal because of that commitment. And what we see out of this report is, you know, a lot of devolution to the provinces of some major decisions, but more importantly, no commitment to decriminalize, and certainly no timeline around that either. The fact is that over the next year, 66,000 Canadians will be arrested for simple pot possession. 20,000 of them will be charged. This report, and certainly what this government is doing, will do nothing to deal with that. That's a real problem. It is certainly a broken promise, and Canadians expect better.
Yeah, let's hear your response to both of those, Bill. I mean, certainly the idea that we need a test to determine when users are under the influence. Yeah. You've spoken about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's be very clear. Right now, Canadians, particularly Canadian youth, use marijuana at higher rates than any other population anywhere in the world. The issue of impaired by drugs, and including marijuana, is a problem today. It's been a problem for decades. It's a problem that must be addressed, and we've said that very clearly. But at the same time, we recognize that the current system of prohibition is not helping to keep it away from kids, and it is facilitating enormous profits by organized crime. And organized crime is responsible for a lot of the violence and victimization that take place in our communities. So taking organized crime out of this business and doing a better job of restricting access to kids is what we said we were going to do. If I just sort of make complete, Nikki suggested that we made the commitment to legalize. That was only half the commitment. And I want to be really clear. The Prime Minister in the throne speech said, we are going to legalize, sure, regulate, and restrict. And for whatever reasons, they kind of leave that out of the discussion. But it's a really important part of it, because it's through the regulation and the restriction that we are going to achieve the public purpose aims of keeping it away from kids, protecting communities, and protecting the health of Canadians. Maybe disagreement, but I would encourage them to read this report. And in all of its complexity, I think the task force did a very good job of addressing a number of these issues, and I think some of the concerns that are being raised can be properly addressed by making yourself better informed.
Okay, Colin.
I think I'm going to disagree, because if you look at the lessons learned, we look at Colorado, the governor down there even said, if you're going to be moving forward with this, make sure that you move very slowly. It would be really disappointing for the Liberals, in order to fulfill a campaign promise, they wouldn't look at the science and the evidence behind this. In Colorado, that did not get rid of organized crime. If you look at the experience down there, organized crime is still quite happy in the Colorado experiment down in that way. So for Bill to say that we're going to take the money out of the hands of organized crime, it's simply false. It's false today.
We get the pesticides out of the pot that you were concerned about.
Do you want to know something? And that would be a good thing, wouldn't it? Yeah. But as Nikki said, this has been a bit of a disaster. You have kids that are getting records now. Mm-hmm. The Liberal government's fine for them to say, you know what, it's still illegal. So enforce the law. But as a police officer, okay, what would you really want to charge a young person? And if you look at the chief of police's...
Let's ask him.
You know what, though? Yeah. He's a former police chief. The Association of Chiefs of Police said it should be a ticketable offense. And to give our party credit, at the last convention, we actually took that position. And I think Nikki's bringing forth, an idea here, because this is going to take years for these guys to put this into place. So it's a typical liberal approach where you shoot and then aim.
Wind this up, Nikki, but I got to get your thoughts on that. You're a former police chief. You know the resources are scarce. Do you really want to be chasing 20, 30, 40,000 kids over the next year?
Don't I spend my life protecting kids and keeping communities safe?
Right.
Mm-hmm. I've also been very much involved in the front line of fighting organized crime. I know from all that experience that organized crime is responsible for much of the violence, as I've said, that take place in our community. We can do a better job. And that's why I support the legalization, regulation, and restriction of marijuana. I know we can do a much better job of keeping it out of the hands of kids.
Why not decriminalize now?
Right now, the decision to sell marijuana to kids is done by a criminal in a stairwell somewhere. It's a lot easier for a kid to buy marijuana today than it is to buy tobacco or alcohol. On the issue of decriminalization, I think the evidence is clear, and the task force speaks to this. Decriminalization doesn't achieve any of the public purpose aims of reducing the social or health harms of marijuana use. It makes it easier for kids to access. It facilitates the criminal market. To speak to Colin's thing, he misrepresented us. He said there's mixed messages. Our government has been crystal clear, and I've said many times.
Don't shake the finger there, Bill.
The law is the law.
That was your promise.
The law is the law is the law, and it should be obeyed. It should be enforced.
Sure. I mean, this is about a liberal broken promise, plain and simple. Justin Trudeau ran on legalizing marijuana. We heard this message across the country. And what we're seeing today is his government stand by a report that not only doesn't talk about that, it doesn't even talk about decriminalizing without a timeline. And to Mr. Blair's comments, my colleague's comments, the failure to decriminalize is going to set tens of thousands of young Canadians and other Canadians as well back further and further. That is not what Canadians were presented with in the last election. It's certainly not what we had today.
Interesting discussion. Thank you all. It's a work in progress. We'll be talking again. Thank you all. After the break, we'll take the theory of legalization and find out how it will meet the market next year. A major marijuana grower and a BC advocate give us the inside look at the retail rollout after these messages. Please stay with us. Well, once the government finishes legalization, the next step is to roll out into the marketplace. Let's preview how that will happen and whether the plan as proposed will work in the world of free enterprise. Jody Emery is owner of Cannabis Culture and a longtime activist in British Columbia, and she joins us from Vancouver. All right, Jody, I know you were kind of skeptical of this task force when it was established. Are you pleasantly surprised by the recommendations?
That's right. I am pleasantly surprised. I'm actually quite shocked that they've offered a few very positive recommendations. I'm just hoping that the Liberal government will actually accept those recommendations.
Yeah.
But that remains to be seen.
Well, if I'm reading your Twitter feed properly, you still find sort of the limits on the size of growing operations too restrictive. What would you want to see in that provision?
Well, I understand the federal government can't really dictate how big all the gardens can be. There are a lot of details that provinces and other areas need to deal with. My main concern, however, is that the government still talks about marijuana being harmful or a threat to people's safety in some way, which isn't true. And in fact, it just continues to let the government and the police work towards continuing enforcement with the money being spent going after growers who are not legal. And I also worry about all of the young people who are still facing criminal records and who are still being arrested every day. So across this country, prohibition is still in effect, and many Canadians are still getting records that will prevent them from traveling and getting jobs. So that's my biggest issue right now. Not so much about the production or how much you can grow. It's the fact that many Canadians who have suffered under prohibition are still going to suffer right now and for years to come until this becomes an actual law.
Do you think what you're reading will work, or do you think the retail model that's currently in place for, say, medicinal marijuana in British Columbia is the way to go. It sounds like they don't really have a clear idea of how it'll be implemented at the provincial level, but what do you think should be done in that sector? What will be the point of contact between consumers and the retail market?
We should have something just like Amsterdam, where adults can go in and access cannabis and use it on site or take it home. And we have a lot of growers who are small craft cannabis growers. They should be allowed to provide their product to the market in some way. But when we're looking at the licensed producers that have been authorized under Health Canada for medical marijuana, I'm concerned that they've made it clear they hope to control most of the legal recreational market. But we know that the licensed producers are not able to meet the demand of the patients, so I don't think they'll be able to meet the demands of the millions of recreational users across Canada. So hopefully they won't be the only ones in control of production of cannabis, and the restrictions banning others will be loosened so more people can participate in the production side.
That's interesting. One idea I hadn't thought of before, but they're thinking of pricing it by its potency of THC. Does that make any sense to you?
That does not make any sense, because if you get a brick of hash from Afghanistan decades ago, that's pretty high THC content. So those sort of limits on THC levels don't really make any sense, especially given that there are old school type of cannabis products that wouldn't really pass. But when you're looking at the government, again, they're talking about concerns about safety in the public, and they like to have some sort of rules in place. But I don't think it's fair to put a sin tax on any cannabis products, because cannabis is not a sin. A sin tax should be for something that's harmful, like alcohol or tobacco, whereas cannabis can actually prevent people from using and abusing alcohol, tobacco, and pharmaceutical drugs. So we should actually encourage cannabis use, because it is a much safer option for people. And it's far less harmful than many of the drugs that people are being pushed by their doctors. So I hope to encourage more of that.
All right, Joe. I'm not sure you're going to get that through this government of encouraging use. But, you know, I'll give you a nod for your experience and expertise. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, for the big grower perspective, we're joined by medicinal marijuana producer Bruce Linton. He is founder of the Canopy Growth Corp, and that produces 14,000 kilograms a year. It's the biggest in Canada. Just start with a blanket assessment. What did you think of this report?
I think they did a really good job, right? They had a very short window to tackle a topic, which is, let's ask a country what we should do about 100 years of prohibition and reintroduce something. And so I thought they did a pretty good job of tackling all the kind of right corners, and there'll be a little bit of work around the edges.
What do you think your industry is going to look like in the aftermath of this report is indeed implemented as written?
Yeah, so I think over the next year, we'll probably need to triple our company again.
I should buy stocks in your company, is what you're saying.
What's going to happen in the sector is, this is Canada, right? And Canada is doing something first. Mm-hmm. And we're doing something bold. And if the companies that are doing it here out of this policy, do you think there's going to be a really big difference in the policy in, I don't know, South American countries or EU countries that look to Canada to say how they did it?
Yeah.
And so it should be good for creating like world leaders here.
She talks fondly about the idea of craft beer equivalents for pot to smaller operations. And the provisions are for, you can grow four plants in your home legally under if this is rolled out. What's the objection to mom and pop producers?
So some of the most profitable licensed producers, so the people who've gone through the same security process as us, are small. And they grow boutique strains in a certain niche area, and it works. Mm-hmm. What I think you find with Tweed is our intent, and what we do is we grow a lot of the plant, then we extract the oils, and then we make finished goods. So if we weren't a big company, we couldn't have gone to see the 16 or 20,000 doctors we've seen. We couldn't think about how do we make medical products in the form of gel capsules and do tests. We also couldn't make branded finished products. So you do need both, but if you want to have the bigger outcomes, you need a bigger company as well.
Tell me about what's going to be the consumer's preferences here. Is smoking marijuana going to be sort of passe, and it'll be all these edible oils, as you pointed out, and then cooking ingredients? Is that the future?
Well, I think in Canada, we've done a pretty good job of almost extinguishing smoking, right? It's turned into something behind a white panel nobody can see. Right. So I think what you'll find with cannabis is, once they can trust the supply chain, meaning we've made it safely, the format they're going to want it in is probably more like we could make it infused into something. We could have it in a vape pen. But it's going to be not smoked. There will be some smoking, but really it's going to be consumed as an oil, and the oil is consumed in a vapor mode. Mm-hmm. And so the effect of that is, you can start to say, certain oils from certain plants will cause perhaps a more euphoric outcome than some which would be contemplative. And so I think what we'll see in Canada is packages that have the name of the company, the active ingredients, and a way to reach the company who produced it. And the reason you want to do that is, you know, when you go into the liquor store, you may ask somebody about which wine, but at least you know red or white. Mm-hmm. And I think in cannabis, there's going to be a whole lot of onboarding and educating, and that's consistent with the report.
You know, a lot of liquor manufacturers take a vested interest in discouraging drunk driving, for example.
Yes.
Do you see producers having an obligation to get involved with making sure that people aren't using their product and hitting the freeway?
They should. You know, what we did at Tweed is almost a year ago, we worked with and sponsored Mothers Against Drunk Driving to also become Mothers Against Drug Driving. And so I think that there's an obligation on the producers to make it such that we have people safely moving away from what they do now, which for sure there are a number of people who've not been educated and do the wrong thing, to get it under control and well managed.
Wow. Well, it's an exciting new future, I guess.
It's a busy day for sure.
Okay. All right, Bruce, thanks for joining us.
Thank
appreciate
you.
That. After the break, we'll look south for analysis on Donald Trump's diplomatic choice to face the world and find out what musician Kanye West was doing rapping with the president-elect. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, to politics south of the border now, where Donald Trump ended weeks of teaser auditions and named his choice for Secretary of State. The president-elect tweeted this morning. He says he's chosen one of the truly great business leaders of the world, Rex Tillerson, chairman and ex-CEO of ExxonMobil, to be Secretary of State. Tillerson faces, well, what could be a difficult confirmation fight in the Senate. Both Republicans and Democrats have openly expressed concern about his ties with Russia and President Vladimir Putin. Well, let's get our expert translation on these and other developments. Rick Klein is ABC Television's political director. He joins us from Washington. I think I'm going to be asking you this question a lot in the next year or two, Rick. What on earth is that all about? No one could have seen this appointment. What's the rationale behind it?
Donald Trump picks a Trump-like figure for his administration. This is someone who's a businessman. You know, Newt Gingrich said about Donald Trump that he's a pirate, and I think he's looking for a band of pirates. And he's looking for people that come from outside the traditional channels, who have the business sense and acumen, who are known on the world stage, but not known in the traditional ways. He's never served in any kind of public service capacity before. Suddenly, he will be the nation's top diplomat.
But, Rick Klein, isn't Russia becoming a bit of a dirty word amid all these election interference allegations by the CIA? I mean, wouldn't a Putin buddy be toxic as a political choice?
He would be toxic to anyone other than Donald Trump. Keep in mind that Donald Trump made very clear during his campaign that he wanted a closer relationship with Russia. He views China as a far larger threat. So I think there's an element of triangulation going on here, and he's picking someone who's a bit of a kindred spirit when it comes to Russia. There's perhaps no American private citizen who has a stronger relationship with Vladimir Putin and to Russia than Rex Tillerson. The deals that they've done there, the friendship that they developed, all of that I think Donald Trump views as valuable. That would put him actually in the minority in his own party in this country, certainly among Democrats as well. But it is his worldview, and it is the worldview that he talked about during the campaign.
Well, let's get to that, because he does have to pass a nomination process. Is this appointment going to clear the Senate?
It won't be automatic, but I would think that it's going to happen, in part because of the timing. It's the beginning of an administration. His own party, the Republicans controlling the Senate, they're not going to want to show any kind of blood in the water to their opposition party, the Democrats, and reject one of Donald Trump's, if not the biggest pick, one of the biggest picks he's going to have. They're going to want to deliver for him and give him a bit of a honeymoon. So I don't think that you're going to find many Republicans who ultimately oppose him. They're going to ask some tough questions, and the Trump administration policy to Russia is going to come under a microscope early, but I would expect him to be confirmed by the Senate.
Well, of interest to us up here in the Great White North, I'm curious, he looks like a bit of a free trader, so that might sort of smooth down Donald Trump's anti-trade deals, won't it?
Yes, he comes at it with a different position on trade generally than Donald Trump has said. But I think you're going to see him fall in line with the White House position on that. I don't think he may advocate for some different things, but I don't think he's going to be able to set his own direction. I think one thing Donald Trump's going to look for here is loyalty. And he's finding someone that's outside of the conventional realm, certainly going to chafe against some of the Washington institutions and chafe against some of the policies he's set out. But I think he is someone that that very much will be looked to enact the Trump agenda.
All right. Well, former Texas Governor Rick Perry, you might remember his infamous, he forgot one of the departments he wanted to eliminate, and that was the Energy Department. I don't know if Donald Trump's proving he has a sense of humor, but he's put Rick Perry in charge of that. What do you make of that?
That's a remarkable doubleheader. So he wanted to eliminate the department. He couldn't think of its name, and now he's going to be the head of that department. Let me say, he was the generally successful governor, three-term governor of Texas, a very large energy-producing, oil-producing state. He knows quite a bit about the issues surrounding energy. So if you factor out the gaffe and the policy positions he had at the time, this would actually be a pretty conventional choice for a Republican administration. I think it's unusual, to say the least. He's going to be replacing a nuclear physicist that served under President Obama in this role. So this is a vastly different direction. But again, a direction that Donald Trump was pretty obvious about telegraphing. His view on energy and the exploitation of natural resources is pretty clear. And I think Rick Perry is going to share that view.
All right, quick last word. What the heck was Kanye West doing in the president-elect's huddle? I can't even imagine what that fit was all about.
It seemed totally normal to me. I mean, Bill Gates was there, Jim Brown, the NFL legend. Why wouldn't Kanye show up? Kanye has been controversial in this. He's talked about running for president. Today his hashtag was 2024. So maybe he runs after Donald Trump leaves office.
All right, makes sense. Everything's making sense these days, I guess. Rick, always a pleasure having you on. Thank you.
Thank you, Don.
Coming up, we're Alberta bound. Our cross-Canada drop-in for a final 2016 read on the provinces continues after these messages. Please stay with us. Welcome back. We're continuing our week-long dash across Canada for a year-end check-in with the provinces and regions. Today, we're going to get the view from Alberta. Rob Murray is a senior business advisor at Dentons, and he joins us with a bit of a delay in the communications from Edmonton. Bob, pipeline euphoria. How is this being seen in a province that's been kind of short of positive news this year?
Yeah, absolutely. What's been really interesting here, I think, is that the opposition is trying very hard to make it out to be a situation where this isn't quite good enough. And of course, the government can really try to celebrate on this in the short term as a major political win by virtue of having struck a deal with the federal government to get their support for these two pipeline projects. But the big question for, I think, all Albertans is going to be whether or not we actually see action on this, whether or not we ever actually see shovels in the ground. Because one of the big questions, as you know, coming out of all of this is whether or not the provincial government and the federal government are going to have the fortitude to push back against those pipeline opponents that have a vested interest in not seeing these projects move forward. So the opposition is proceeding on a basis that Northern Gateway, not getting Northern Gateway, was a little bit of a failure, and questioning whether or not we're actually going to see these projects move forward, but certainly in the short term, a major political victory for Rachel Notley.
Okay, but the flip side of that, I guess, is a bit of a quid pro quo, is the introduction of carbon pricing next year, and we're seeing some protests in the big cities. Is the opposition deep, or do you think it's fringe opposition, and how much of a risk is it to Rachel Notley?
Well, what's really interesting here is that what we're hearing a lot of opposition about right now is what the deal was between Rachel Notley to get Mr. Trudeau's support for the pipeline projects. And there seems to be some quid pro quo by virtue of the fact that Mr. Trudeau moved forward with the pipeline projects, but Ms. Notley's not pushing back very hard against the federal carbon pricing situation that's being introduced in Ottawa. And so opposition Albertans and conservative Albertans are certainly speaking very loudly about the fact that Ms. Notley seems to have rolled over on a Made in Ottawa plan when Albertans were told that if we had a Made in Edmonton or Made in Alberta plan that things wouldn't be imposed on us. But I think they're certainly anticipating quite a bit of opposition to these pipeline projects, both in BC and elsewhere, and even here in Alberta. But what's going to be most interesting is how Ms. Notley is actually going to be able to navigate some of these things. So on one hand, we see her championing pipelines right now and trying to move these projects forward, and yet still sticking to a position on Keystone XL, for instance, which is something that she deems not to be in Alberta's interest, which we anticipate the Trump administration is quite likely to want to see move forward. So Ms. Notley has to be very careful in the line that she walks with regards to these pipelines, as well as the climate change plan, because, of course, in about 2 weeks, Albertans are going to be paying a lot more for a lot of things with the introduction of that carbon tax. And now we're going to have a Made in Ottawa plan simultaneously. And Ms. Notley's not pushing back very hard, according to a lot of conservative Albertans. So she's walking a number of fine lines simultaneously.
Speaking of conservative Albertans, it's kind of interesting what's going on. Jason Kenney, the former cabinet minister here in Ottawa, has gone out there to unite the two right-leaning parties. He seems to be on track to take over the Progressive Conservative Party before he tries to eat the Wild Rose Party. What do you see happening there now, and how do you see it developing over the next year?
Well, what I think has been most interesting about the Unite the Right discussion is that, I mean, previous to the last 6 months, we've had a fairly hyper-polarized political climate here in Alberta in general. And now you're seeing some of that polarization even among the conservative parties in Alberta. So whether or not Jason Kenney is actually going to be able to survive that delegated convention process and come out on top and then start looking to the Wild Rose to start seeing how negotiation talks can possibly work to unite the right. I mean, all eyes really need to be on Brian Jean and how Brian Jean, the leader of the Wild Rose Party, is going to respond to some of this. I mean, traditionally and politically, he would fall very much in line with a Jason Kenney style of conservative politics. We know they served together in Ottawa in the Harper government. So what this process is actually going to look like is going to get really interesting, but there really does seem to be a bitter divide that's starting to emerge between those that consider themselves to be on the right and conservatives and disenfranchised progressive conservatives from that umbrella party that existed for 40 years, where you had people on the far right as well as the middle and some on the left. And so what those disenfranchised people are going to be doing on the progressive side, whether or not they look to the NDP, as we saw Sandra Jansen do, or whether they're looking for a more centrist alternative, and whether this also speaks to the growth in the Alberta Party or the growth in the Alberta Liberal Party, which has been fairly dead for quite some time. So there's a lot of intrigue, not just on the right, but also in the center.
All right. Interesting times in Alberta coming into next year. Okay, Rob Murray, have a good holiday, and we'll talk to you next year. After the break, we'll bring you some Justin Trudeau magic. Yesterday, the Prime Minister admitted he'd been lobbied at fundraisers. Today, he pretended that hadn't happened. Our press gallery gives it a closer look. Please stay with us. Welcome back. The Tuesday edition of the Press Gallery never goes to pot, at least as far as I know. They join us for their always shrewd insights. Tonda McCharles is the Toronto Star journalist. The Toronto Star journalist. Robert Fife is the Globe and Mail bureau chief and co-writer for all those pay-for-access scoops that Justin Trudeau would like to forget. Let's talk about that, Bob. The Prime Minister was in question period under fire. He seemed to answer a lot of the questions the same way as before, but he did make one change. What was it?
Well, actually, he's changed his whole message. He's always said we follow all the rules until yesterday when he got caught and he said, well, of course I talk about government business at these fundraisers. Today he had to have a new message because the opposition were after him so hard. His message now is, Don, yes, I go to these things, but I go to these things with these wealthy people so I can tell them that I'm taxing them and I'm champion the middle class by taking money from you and giving it to them. A completely new message.
It's Robin Hood.
He's Robin Hood, exactly. And, you know, this is starting to look like farce. And so then Ron Ambrose gets up and says, what about the Chinese billionaires that show up to use it too and use their influence to buy off the Trudeau Foundation?
Right.
He gets up and says, the Trudeau Foundation is an independent foundation, and the whole house erupts in laughter and jeers.
Yeah, his brother's still running it.
Government still puts two directors on.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, they put in. Yeah, okay. Tonda, this story just keeps on giving, particularly this guy. How much trouble is he in? Justin Trudeau on
Well,
this.
Look, they're holding fast. Maybe they're just hoping to wait it out until Parliament rises this week for this Christmas break.
Yeah, I think he's probably finished
back.
Today. I think that was the last
UP. So maybe they're hoping that they can get through Christmas without it being a daily reminder in the House and regroup for January. But it seems to me that these stories aren't going to go away. That we're going to learn more details about some of the other fundraisers and who attended them, even though it's not, as the government claims, transparent on any website right now. That information will emerge, so I don't see it going away. They're talking about needing some kind of public interest process if there was ever going to be a change to the rules. So I don't know, maybe they'll put it to a parliamentary committee or something. I don't know.
I mean, we're going to save our predictions for next week with you guys, but can he keep going forward without sort of repealing this whole idea of fundraisers, maximum donations for access?
You talk to Liberal MPs privately, they all say this is really hurting us, and it's hurting our brand, and it's hurting the Prime Minister's own integrity. And, you know, he won on a really positive message, and he won on promising higher ethical standards. And this doesn't meet the smell test, and I think they're going to have to rethink this and come up with something that will change the channel. And because, you know, everybody can understand that. The middle class can understand they can't pay $1,500 to walk into a room at some mansion of some wealthy person and get the chance to bend the Prime Minister's ear. And you know what? I really don't think the Prime Minister is telling these people, hey, I'm taxing you guys so I can help the middle class.
I got a Liberal fundraising pitch, and all they wanted was $3 from me. So I thought, they realize I have no money.
No influence.
And don't really care if I
no
meet
access.
These guys. I meet them here. I'd like to get your thoughts on the pot. It was a big story today. We're going to set new ground, if this works, around the world. Is this an asset or a liability, you think, for Justin Trudeau's Liberals? Is this a good thing for them? Or is the public not as far along this? Because this report went a little bit further than most people thought.
It certainly went further than Canadian doctors have recommended they go in setting that legal smoking age or,
18,
you know, marijuana age to 18. Look, I think it depends on how much of it the government does adopt in legislation, because they've also recommended a massive regime with regulations, public education campaign, research, law enforcement, boosts to law enforcement. But it seems to me that already we've already had committee study how stretched the police are in this country, how budgets are over the top everywhere. So unless they adopt it all, I don't know that they'll achieve the goal they want, which is to keep it in a public safety, public health framework.
I'm very skeptical that their idea that they're going to keep this out of the hands of, you know, teenagers or young people, because certainly they'll probably take it out of the hands of organized crime and give it to the provinces and the government to make money. But it's not going to be it's going to be easier, I think, for younger people to actually get pot. When I was growing up as a kid, before I was 21, I was able to get booze when I was 14 years old because I could get somebody's brother to go get me a bottle at the liquor store. So it's actually going to be easier for younger people to get drugs, and they'll probably grow their own.
I think there's also a concern, certainly, you know, for parents. I have teenagers, and I'm concerned around the normalization of the use of pot and. Will law enforcement be able to detect drug impairment on our roads? Mm-hmm. So, look, they've got, I think, a massive sort of complex issue on their hands, but they've legislated complex issues. They did assisted dying in 3 months last year. Let's see what they do. They say they're still going to plow ahead in the spring.
I got to ask you what you guys, I think the oddest couple in politics this next year is going to be Stéphane Dion trying to deal with Rex Tillerson, the U.S. Secretary of State. Is this going to work, Donna? Can you just see these two getting along?
There are many mismatched pairs when we see
the
counterparts.
The most mismatched
pair. Oh, no, I don't know if it even is. Actually, Trump and Trudeau are pretty mismatched.
That's pretty mismatched,
you know?
Okay.
I think, you know, look at they've got a guy running the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency down there who... No, I think there are many mismatches in this group, and it's going to be a high-wire act for the government.
Bob?
Well, you know, former Secretary of State Jim Baker and former U.S. Defense Secretary under both Obama and George Bush, Robert Gates, have both spoken very highly of this new Secretary of State who runs Exxon, and I have a lot of respect for those men. So if they think that this guy is capable, and he has run a major corporation, I mean, the big concern is his ties to Russia, but I think the jury should be out. We should give him a chance to see how he performs.
He's certainly going to do well by pipelines, or Canada would seem to be, I mean, Trump's already said Keystone's going ahead. This guy's going to go hallelujah and put his shoulder behind it, I would think. So that's a good thing. Quick last word to you. Health Accord, the provinces are going their own way on that?
Well, they've proposed something to the feds, and if they have, a lot of the provinces on board to, form a united front to the feds, it'll be hard for the feds to negotiate against them. This is an Ontario proposal that's come forward to ratchet up to 5.2% annual hikes in spending on health by the feds, and to stretch it out over 10 years. Look, from the provinces I've spoken to, a lot of them, you'd think they'd be complaining about strings attached to the funding. They're not. They're actually saying it's not a hill to die on. So the question is, can they form a united front? And we've seen in the past that doesn't always happen.
5.2% of the feds,
I don't think
go
they're
going
to get anywhere near that, but they are going to get some dedicated funding for seniors and for mental health, and with some kind of an escalator.
But if it doesn't carry on beyond the 3 years that
it's going to be, it'll be 10 years.
All right.
For sure.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
And they'll have that deal, I think, on Monday.
You heard it here first. Bob Fife, thank you. All right, talk to you guys next week. And that's it for today's Political Power Plays. Anita Sharma is standing by with the latest news headlines. Thanks for watching the broadcast or listening to the podcast. Here's how you can reach us with show reactions and ideas. We're back tomorrow with all the big moves in Parliament Hill across the country and around the world. Hope you can join us at this time on CTV News Channel 4.